Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Kevin Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the British.
Yeah.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show, our second of 2018. And pleased to say that our guest on this show is former Kookaburra Grant Schubert. Now, in his playing career, he won pretty much everything there was to win. He won the World Cup, he won an Olympic gold medal, Commonwealth gold medal, won the Champions Trophy, but he'd never played in Pakistan. And he headed over there with a World 11 to take on the under-19s to try and regenerate hockey in Pakistan. And we're going to hear from him about how he found it, how they went, and how sore he was after the games. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And John, good to be back.
It is indeed. Ashley, plenty happening in the sports world.
Wow, there's been loads, hasn't there, in the last couple of weeks?
Oh, yeah. All over the shop. This, well, from my perspective, there's just been huge amounts of hockey. We've had the cricket and
England actually winning some games.
There's been stuff going on in South Africa too.
There's been the new stadium in Perth.
New stadium, yeah.
Which we're going to avoid that for now. I think it's been talked about enough.
Well, what can we really say? They've had, what, one event? Yeah, I mean, let it settle in for a while before we really start picking it apart.
I do find it incredible that you build a stadium and don't build a car park, but hey, that's...
that's another story. It's a long walk across that bridge, or it will be.
Anyway, shall I start?
Yeah, you go for it.
All right, my topic is the Socceroos have obviously announced their coach for the World Cup, and that is Brian van Marwijk from the Netherlands. Now, he coached the Netherlands to the gold medal match in 2010, and he's obviously managed to get Saudi Arabia to qualify through the Asian qualifiers this time to go to, Russia.
Russia,
that's it.
Yeah.
I was going to go Rio for a reason. But
same part of the alphabet.
Yeah, starts with R. Now, look, I think there's no doubt that he is a quality coach. I think that it's interesting that they've said, the FFA, that one of the reasons that they were keen on him was his adaptability. I also find it very interesting that he never applied for the job, and that it was the panel of Mark Schwarzer, Marco Bresciano and Stan Lazaridis who apparently said to Luke Casserly, the high performance director, they felt he was the man that they should be talking to. And so then they approached him. He was in fact the only one of the coaches that they met with to discuss whether that he wanted the job. Now, again, I question that. I think for such a big role, surely you'd talk to more than one person unless you are absolutely 100% sure, which it appears they were, that he was the man that they wanted. Now, the thing I have a concern about here, and I find it very, very strange, is why is Australia spending just under $2 million to have a guy just coach from now through to the World Cup, and then he's going to walk away? Now, if he does a great job, and let's be honest, this guy's credentials are very, very good as a coach at club level and also at international level. Now, you're thinking, well, if he does a good job at the World Cup and we see real progress in a bunch of who I class as, by international standards, a very average bunch of players, international standards, I'm saying, not club standards. If he makes them suddenly really perform well, and if he performs what to me will be a miracle and gets them out of their group and into the second round. Now, he said he believes we can survive the group stage. Now, quite what survive means, I think he means...
Not dying.
I think he means that they can actually get out of the group, but that's obviously lost in translation. But I just find it very strange that you would... Where's the long-term planning in this? You know, apparently they've already signed a deal. My understanding and my sources tell me that allegedly a deal has been signed that Graham Arnold will take over after the World Cup. Graham Arnold, Sydney FC coach, will be the coach at the Asia Cup. He will also be taking quite a lot of his support staff from Sydney FC with him. So it's going to be very interesting how Sydney FC cope with losing a great chunk of their backroom staff to go to the Socceroos. But I just don't see, to me, that doesn't make sense. Like, if van Marwijk does a really good job, I would say I'd want him to stay on because he may be the man to carry us and regenerate the game here. Is Graham Arnold going to be able to regenerate the game? Sure, he's done a great job at Sydney FC. He's also got the best squad in the A-League. Now, that's credit, I think, to, again, the football management team behind the scenes there in that they've managed to recruit those players within the salary cap, or they've found loopholes in the salary cap in order to recruit those players, because no other team comes close in terms of the international experience that Sydney FC has. And if they weren't top of the league, you'd be going, why are they not top of the league? So is it just he's got the best quality team? Is it that he's the best coach? Currently on paper, yes, the results would say he's the best coach, and they are the best team. I think they've hardly lost a game in one or two games in 18 months. So they're clearly the best team. But is Graham Arnold the right choice? Are we then going to actually regress the game in Australia by going back to a local band coach? Now, I know that's going to upset some people, but I just think if you want the game to progress, you need coaches that the players are inspired by and who can actually inspire the players. And I'm not sure that Arnold at international level is the man for that. And if Van Marwijk does a good job at the World Cup, I would like to have seen him stay on and take that team further and see how far he could take it.
Where's Van Marwijk stand in this? I mean, he might have been approached with the continuation of the job. Come and do the World Cup and then you can stay, we'll pay you, you can live in Australia, maybe your kids want to go to school here, all of that sort of stuff.
Well, the talk is, John, that the thing that appealed to him was the fact that it was short-term.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. He can go to the World Cup.
And that was why he didn't apply for it.
It's a shop window. Oh, you want me? Yep, sure. Oh, but I'm only doing the World Cup. I've got other things I'm doing after July or whenever it happens to be. And so you can only have me until the end of the World Cup. I've got other things to do. That might very well be the position they found themselves in. So then well, we want you to do this. Okay then. I mean, essentially that's what the Gus Hiddink deal was, wasn't it? He was only ever going to do the World Cup. He was never going to stay on.
Hiddink, it was open, actually. Okay. From my understanding at that time, it was never... Yeah, I think in his mind, he knew he was never going to stay on. But it was open-ended that it was his call.
Okay.
If he wanted to stay on, he could have stayed on. And the FFA wanted him to stay on. But, you know, he obviously wanted to go back to club football and was doing that. And it was far more lucrative to him because he wasn't getting paid... I mean, there was bonus related to his salary at that time, and we're talking 10 years ago now. Now, Van Marwijk's wages are reportedly 1.8 million for the World Cup, plus a bonus if he gets them out of the group stage. Now, it's interesting that he only wanted that, but it was Australia that decided that they only wanted the foreign coach for the World Cup. And I just find, is that really good planning for football in this country? I can't see it. Now, I know some of the other names that were thrown around, like I think it was Roberto Mancini, it was going to cost $4 million for him. Now, Australia doesn't have that money, but then maybe just lower your standards or sights on the really big names, but find a really good coach. And there's plenty of those about who I think could have done a good job and could have carried on. And I'm just not sure that this is the way to go. Now, I did read a really good article by, I think it was Luke Wiltshire, or it may have been one of the other players, was saying that what he thought was really good is it'll give this buffer between Ange and the next Australian coach, in that this new coach will come in, there'll be a different style of play, and then, you know, there won't be just Ange did it this way, Arnie wants to do it that way. But then do you really need, surely then it could be even worse for the players, because Van Marwijk may have a style of play which he said he will adapt the players to play the way he wants them to play, which is what Gus Hiddink did. And if you look, Gus Hiddink restricted the amount of players he used, and he said he was never going to use more than, I think it was 15 players that he felt were capable of playing at the World Cup. And I think he only used 15 players. It may have been 16, but he certainly didn't use anyone beyond that. All the other squad players were never going to get a game. And I just think, to me it sits really strange, and I think it's a regressive move.
It's interesting you use the term overseas coach there, because I thought by now Dutch soccer coaches were automatically Australian citizens. We keep going back to the Dutch. That I find interesting, because especially with Pim Verwijk and, who was the other Dutchman, not Hiddink, between...
No, it's Pim and Gus. So it was Gus, then Pim Verwijk, and then Holger was German.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm making a mistake.
But we have had at the AIS, we've had, you know, Jan Verslaan, we've had Han Berger as the technical director, we had Rob Barn as the technical director. Now, there was, again, a really good article, if anyone wants to read it, that it's on our Not the Footy Show Facebook page, because America's done the same thing, and that they went with Dutch coaches. And they're saying, but if you look at the Dutch system at the moment, it's horribly flawed. They didn't qualify for the Euros, and they haven't qualified for the World Cup. Now they've got still good coaches, but their system at the moment is, and it was saying the system in America isn't working, and the Dutch coaches aren't assimilating to the system. So there's a breakdown between the coaching and the system of the game being run in America.
Yeah.
And I read this and I was like, wow, just substitute USA for Australia,
yeah,
and you've got exactly the same situation happening in this country. Because, again, what they're saying there is they're just developing coaches, giving them a piece of paper, but they're not necessarily the best coaches.
Could we have talked Fergie out of retirement?
You don't know. You may well have done.
I mean, that would have been a coup. Australians would have loved that.
Wow. Well, there's certain people, a certain TV station that's free to air wouldn't have liked that, because anti-British, you know, anything that's British has got to be bad.
Wasn't there an article that came out this week written by a player or a coach saying, what's all this anti-British stuff about? We love British football. It was the Dutch guy. Didn't you repost it? The black and white photo of the training in the 70s.
Oh, it was Rinus Michels. Yeah, yeah, it was talking about that and how the British influence on total football.
Yeah.
How Vic Buckingham was one of the coaches that was at Ajax before, and Rinus Michels learnt from him and then developed what has now become total football. So, yeah, it was all spawned from that. And I'm actually reading an excellent book at the moment called Mister, and it's all about the English coaches that couldn't get work after the war, or after the First World War, and even some before the First World War, who went to Europe to spread the gospel of football. And I mean, it's amazing. And I hadn't, even though I follow the game of football, I'd never appreciated that Barcelona, probably the biggest club in the world today, that on their crest, there is the cross of St. George. And the reason is the club was actually founded by three Englishmen.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I bet they wish they had their shares still.
I don't think they're alive now, but I'm sure they would. But it's something that, you know, I've watched Barcelona, I've seen that shirt a million times, and I have to be honest, it was something I'd never actually noticed. But yeah, look, I just wonder if the Dutch system's the right way to go. I think Van Marwijk is a good coach. I think he'll do well at the World Cup. It'll be interesting how he progresses the players that he has. And whether he plucks anyone from almost obscurity and raises them up, but we'll have to wait and see.
I think you've got to be very careful too about trying to impose something on a group of players. Like, if it's all very well and good to play a certain style, but you need players of a certain style to fit into that. Now, can you imagine, say, a coach coming in during the golden era and say, well, Mark Viduka, we're not playing you because we don't believe in bombing it up forward and giving a bloke like you an opportunity to work their magic. We've got a different game system.
But
imagine the outcry that would happen then.
But going back to that article that you alluded to there, that's on the Facebook page about Rinus Michels, because the thing that was interesting about that was he was saying that the key was to have a structure. To have a structure in attack, to have a structure in defence, but also give the players their freedom.
Yeah.
And the key thing was to train them or coach them to know when to use that freedom within the context of a game to turn a game. And that, to me, is something that gets lost in a lot of coaching when we're playing, especially as football's now become such a structured game, is we're seeing players not being given that freedom. And yet, to me, that's what people pay their money to go and see, is they want to see those special moments. Are you trying to tell me that Ronaldo and Messi aren't given that license? Of course they are.
Yeah.
And that's why they stand out in the world of football today.
We keep getting told by the free-to-air station that you're referring to that, you know, English football, Highway 1, bad, bad, bad. And you know what? It is bad, bad, bad when that's all you have. If that's your game plan, it's terrible. But when you've got the ability to go Highway 1 and also do these other things, mate, that is a killer weapon.
Absolutely.
So you've got to be able to do it all. One thing won't get you past the post. You've got to be able to do it all.
Hi, I'm Chris Sorello from the Kookaburras, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and it's time to turn our attention to our guest on this podcast. As we mentioned at the top of the show, he's won everything there is in the game, but he had never played international hockey in Pakistan. So when the invitation came, Grant Schubert said, count me in. So we're going to hear now from our guest today, former Kookaburra, Grant Schubert. Grant Schubert, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks, Ashley. It's good to be here once again. It is indeed. Now, obviously, you've just returned from this tour of Pakistan, hockey tour there. Now, first of all, how did that come about that you got invited?
Yeah, it was, look, an amazing experience, first of all, and never played there before. And I think it sort of came about. I was doing a bit of running and putting a bit of stuff on social media. So I think it got out there from Don Pryor that I was doing a bit of running. So I thought I was fit. And he was in contact with Rob Lathouse from Holland, who was also an umpire. And he sent me an email to see if I was interested, and yeah, I said yes and took up the opportunity and went from there.
Was it the fact that you'd never played there that appealed to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think growing up, you always spoke to the old guys that played for the Kookaburras, and obviously being good friends with Don Pryor, that they played in front of, you know, 45 to 60,000 people in Pakistan. And we missed out on the opportunity to do that in 2004 for the Champions Trophy that was there. But, you know, for me, they're hockey lovers. So to go to a place like Pakistan, which some consider the home of hockey, was really good to travel there and play in Lahore and also Karachi.
And, I mean, obviously, a lot of your teammates were guys you played against for years. It must have been good to be turn up with them and be on the same side as some of them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for almost a decade, I played against, you know, guys like, you know, Rob Breckers and Matthias Brouwer and Roderick Woestoff. So those guys from Holland, you know, you fought so many battles with at the Olympic Games and Champions Trophy. So to play with those guys was a bit of fun. We're obviously a lot older now, in our mid-30s. So for us, it was all about the enjoyment and bringing hockey back to Pakistan.
How many training sessions did you have before or did you have none?
Literally, I think there was 11 there the day before the first game in Karachi. So we basically played I think it was a 6-on-5 game, and more so just for the media the day before. And then a few of the guys, some of them missed their plane heading to Karachi, and some only flew in that night. So we literally hadn't played at all, you know, with the guys before that first game in Karachi.
Now, you're still playing for UWA here, but, I mean, are all the other guys still playing as well?
Yeah, still having a whack around with the twos at UWA there. And, yeah, a lot of the other guys are still playing twos at home. I know David Alegre, he's still playing, you know, in the ones team back in Spain there. So there are a few guys that still, the younger Argentinian guys, they're still sort of up and coming, playing with the international scene there. So we had a couple of young guys to sort of offset us old blokes. So it was really enjoyable to play in that team, even though we were only together for a short amount of time.
And when you got there, was there a lot of hype around it? Because as you said, there'd been no international hockey since 2004 when the Champions Trophy was held there. So you would think a nation like that, the excitement would have been really high.
Yeah, look, I think when we first got there, we missed the bulk of it when the guys arrived from Holland. So they had a fairly big presence when they arrived to the airport. We had a smaller number, probably a handful or so of reporters that were there when we first rocked up. But our first... the first time we went to the hockey ground there in Karachi, and we had the media press conference there, I think there would have been 50 to 100, you know, cameras there, and the whole, you know, that sort of side of the field was just littered with cameras. So that first press conference was just unbelievable, and I've got photos of it, and you don't see that with the professional sports here in Australia with the AFL and the rugby. So to see that happen there in Karachi and also Lahore, I think just showed us how much passion they have for that sport there in their country.
Now, you mentioned a short preparation time, but you had a good result in the first game.
Yeah, we got run around. We played the under-19 Pakistan team, basically. You know, as everyone knows, they've got plenty of run in their legs. And so the run is ragged for about the first sort of quarter and a half. And then we sort of switched on and realised that we couldn't actually play like we were 25-year-olds anymore and chase them around. So we really did slow down the pace. We held on to the ball and ended up scoring, I think it was 4 or 5 goals in the third quarter and sort of killed the game. So to get a 5-run result in the first game was really good, but we had some sore bodies later on that night.
How long was your recovery time between games?
Well, yeah, 2 nights, and I don't think I played 2 games in 3 days for probably about, I reckon, 6 or 7 years. So I was a little bit sore, but look, we had a really relaxed group there, which was good, and had a bit of recovery, but, you know, they wanted us to enjoy our time there. So, you know, we had a couple of beers in between and, you know, and just really relaxed and had a lot of fun. And guys pulled up pretty well, although a little bit sore for the second game. You know, we still played quite well.
And what were the crowds like?
It was a little bit quiet in Karachi. We didn't have a really big crowd there in Karachi, and I think they had a few issues with transport and that sort of stuff and organising to get the game there. But I think the online presence was pretty good. And then in Lahore, we probably had about sort of, I reckon, probably 4,000 to 5,000 people there. And you know, although being in a massive stadium that fits 45,000 people, it didn't look like there was a lot, but the noise was still, you know, unbelievable for that amount of people. And if anyone's, you know, played games against Pakistan, you only need 1,000 people and they probably take over, you know, 10,000 Australian supporters. So very fanatical, and, you know, it's just a great experience to play, you know, in that massive stadium, which is the biggest in the world for hockey.
Having obviously been out of the international scene for so long, and I've read stuff when they're training camps, they've had to move them because the facilities have not been good enough, the pitch has been too bobbly. What were the facilities like?
Yeah, actually really good. The pitches there played really well. I don't think they'd been down for, you know, for too long. So the pitches itself were really good. Obviously, the stadium is not being used for a good part of sort of 14, 15 years, I suppose, internationally. They're going to take a hit, you know, facility-wise sort of thing. And I think that would happen with any stadiums around the world. You know, you see that with Olympic Games stadiums and that sort of stuff when they're just let go. They're always in sort of some sort of, you know, need of repair. So the stadium Lahore, you know, was actually really good. I was quite surprised how good a condition, you know, that was in. So I thought the facilities there were great, and they can only get better, hopefully, when they start to play more and more, you know, games there.
And obviously the big concern and the reason nobody's going to play them in Pakistan is security and safety. I mean, did you ever feel threatened, or was it just fantastic, the organisation?
Yeah, absolutely not. I never felt, you know, threatened or anything like that. The security is really good. We always had transport to and from the grounds, and especially in Lahore, they sort of said that we'd be treated like the president was coming, and we didn't sort of really believe that. But when we rocked up, you know, the streets were clear, so we could just get to and from without any hassles or anything like that. So the security was really good there, and although everyone that we spoke to said it wasn't necessarily, they just really didn't want anything to happen. So everyone that we spoke to, all the public, they're all so friendly, and you know, they're just such a sport loving nation. And you know, for those few things that happen, you know, for them to not have sport in their country is a real hole in their, I think, that their community and their culture.
And it's so hard for them because financially, you know, you're always playing away from home, the costs are there, and I know that's one of the things that their coaching staff has said has held them back, is it's just so expensive to maintain the development programs while still getting the national team to play in competitions where they can still gain world rankings points to be competitive and in the top 10. So it's a really vicious circle.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it'd be the same here in Australia. If we had to spend money to travel and play anywhere internationally, obviously your national body is going to take some sort of, you know, hit, and then it's harder to progress your juniors through. And I think that's also been the hardest thing for, you know, Pakistan with hockey and sport, is the fact that they haven't had so many or any international sport there for so long now. It's always going to take a hit, I think, for your juniors coming through, because I remember when I, you know, grew up, that the best thing for me was to see my idols play, you know, in the flesh and blood. And, you know, and that being any sport, not just hockey, but going to the cricket, going to the basketball, going to the footy, when you see your idols play, not just on TV, but live, that drive for you to be better at your sport only pushes you along further. So the more that can happen for those kids in Pakistan can only be beneficial for them pushing forward and making, or, you know, having better outcomes on the international scene, sports result-wise.
I couldn't agree with you more in that. I think it's very important that you see your heroes live. Yeah. But I mean, what was the reaction? Because obviously you were playing the under-19s. They are the guys that are earmarked to be the future of Pakistan hockey. Did they appreciate you guys being there? Did they know who you were as well? And did they appreciate sort of the history that some of you guys had?
Yeah, look, it was actually really good. I mean, these guys, I think, you know, more so it's probably their parents, and who knows, their parents probably, you know, had a chat with them saying, look, you're playing against these guys, you know, who knows if they looked us up on the internet to, you know, to get some old footage, which is almost black and white for us back in those days. But I think, you know, we sat down at a few dinners that we had there. We had a few sort of gala events while we're there, and we sat down for a few lunches and mingled with these young guys. And obviously, you know, they are very young, and not a lot of them spoke a lot of really good English, but there were guys there that did, and they were able to translate it to the other guys. So we had some really good conversations with those guys, and especially I think after the first game, where, you know, it sort of ebbed and flowed from that first game, and the way that we changed how we played our game, you know, it was really, I think, difficult for them to adjust. But we had conversations with them, you know, as I said, at these lunches, and hopefully they took some of that on board, and you know, can hopefully further progress them as time goes on.
Was there some talent there?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, as I said, they're still very raw. So a lot of them were, you know, 17 to 19 years, and there's no way that I was playing against international guys at that age, sort of thing. So it would have been a massive eye-opener for them. But, look, plenty of talent, plenty of skill, and obviously plenty of pace. But it's always, I think, for those Asian nations, transferring that into the seniors to become more diligent structure-wise is always the biggest challenge for them.
Which kind of leads into a question which you don't have to answer, but it's got a lot of media coverage in Pakistan, is that there is a strong feeling that they need to have a foreign coach just to bring them up to the tactical level that you just touched on there to play internationally. Do you think it would benefit them from having an international coach?
Yeah, look, it's always, and, you know, we speak about Pakistan and India as well, and you know, getting structure put in place for those guys, and it's always really tough. You know, I think everybody knows that there's, you know, a lot of stuff that happens politically, you know, behind the scenes that we don't, you know, necessarily see here, and the difference in culture between, you know, an Australian way and a European way is always hard to enforce onto these guys, and trying to get that balance, I think everyone that's sort of gone there has found it really difficult. So you know, you don't want to hold them back, but I think, you know, there needs to be some sort of structure put in place for those guys, and showing that you need to have this work rate to really compete with you know, these bigger European nations, and obviously Australia and New Zealand as well.
I don't think we ever want to see them lose their own identity and style. But finally, I mean, where does it go from here? Is there going to be another tour next year to try and keep this going? And if there was, would you go again?
Look, I think all the guys that went over there, you know, would love to go back. Obviously, we'd be another year older, and would I think a few of the boys would put in a bit of pre-season for it. But look, I really enjoyed it, and, you know, I'd love to go back there again. And I think, you know, it can only improve if things happen there more often. I think what we found there is the fact that nothing had been held there for so long. There were so many people that wanted to help out that organisation sort of fell away a little bit. I mean, things got done, but they were sort of just delayed a little bit. But you saw the passion and the love that they have for the game, and they just want things, you know, really to happen and things to come back there. So I think the more often that, you know, they can, I suppose, start off with a few short tours to get things going, it's only going to bring the crowd back. And I think that was probably one thing, is that maybe people didn't really believe that things were, you know, actually happening there. So, you know, that the crowds weren't as big as sort of what was expected. So I really hope that we can get hockey going back in Pakistan. And as we've seen over the last, you know, 10 years, bringing hockey back to India as well has only been beneficial to the game. So hopefully, you know, all the nations can get behind Pakistan and the FIH, and everyone can bring, you know, the sport back. Because I think really it's probably the only place that you're going to be able to get 45 to 60,000 people come to a hockey game. And that, in my eyes, can only be beneficial to every international guy that's played hockey for the country.
Well, Grant, great to catch up, and thanks for sharing your memories of the tour.
Yeah, no worries.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Jacoby from Germany, playing for the Delhi Wave Riders. You're hearing Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and that was Grant Shubert. And of course, John, anyone that loves the game of hockey wants to see Pakistan climb back up to the top. And I would have thought it was a great experience for those under 19 players to play against some of the stars of yesteryear. And it was good to know that the stars of yesteryear still got some running in their legs, or certainly that their brains are still functioning.
Absolutely. And I dare say they would have still been a formidable side. A lot of going around. If you're an attacking player looking at that team, you'd be thinking, wide. Go around, not through, around. Nice guy, Grant. He's a tremendous fella. And
the only man from South Australia in the 2004 squad when they won the gold medal.
Yeah, well, he grew up in...
Good trivia question.
It is. Yeah, he's South Australian. I think that question will be asked in South Australian quiz nights. just mentioning... The Pakistan and how everybody wants to... The first international game of hockey I ever saw was India versus Pakistan over here at the Perth Hockey Stadium during the Asanda tournament. And it was packed. It was packed and rocking temporary stands all the way around, filled. There were thousands there, and it was the most immense experience. And I think I'm still trying to chase that. In my own head, you know.
But that goes back to what Grant said in that interview, was it's so important that young people get to see the stars of that era play.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't necessarily need to be international. It's whether they're stars of AFL, star of the A-League, star of the NBA or the ABL in Australia. You know, there's various things, but you want to watch the guys that are at the top in your state or international whenever the chance comes, because they're the inspiration.
Yeah, and I'd love to see that again. I think on the reverse stick, Matt and I are already dobbed in. If India plays Pakistan in Pakistan, we're going. We've already said we'll be first in line for the first ticket sold. Thank you very much. So, better start.
I don't think it'll be an organised queue to get the ticket.
No, probably not.
Anyway, now, your topic.
My turn. Hey, two things, actually, on cricket. Well, one's not real. One's sort of inspired by cricket. One's directly about cricket. We saw the situation in South Africa last week in the India Test, South Africa Test series, of a day's play being called off halfway through a test and then recommencing the next day because the wicket was dangerous. I'm really confused by the situation, because surely the wicket's going to be dangerous the next day as well. There's not too much you can do that's going to change that with a cricket wicket overnight. I wouldn't have thought.
It was strange.
Did you see it? The only ball I saw was the one in particular that struck the batsman on the helmet. Wasn't de Klerk, who am I thinking of?
De Villiers?
No, it wasn't de Villiers. I can't remember the batsman's name. But they walked off after he was hit. And I just... Because it's one ball in isolation, you don't see the rest of it, so I can't make a real comment about how bad the wicket was, only take it from what was printed. But it seemed to me, he just lost that ball. It wasn't a particularly brutal delivery. It was short, he was already moving back. He'd already picked up it was a short ball, and he just lost it. We've seen far more dangerous pitches than that.
I think there's only been one time where they've abandoned it for a pitch before, and that was England in the West Indies.
Yeah. That was terrible.
That was bad. I think Alex Stewart was captain, if I remember rightly. That's your one thing anyway. Game abandoned.
The game wasn't abandoned.
They came back.
And India won. Yeah. What I thought was that the Indians' response afterwards, saying, hang on, we made 260 odd or whatever it was out there. We got hit. We got nothing dangerous when we were getting hit. Anyway, the other thing was the betting scandal. Well, not, it's, is it a betting scandal?
The investigation into the game in... Dubai, is that the one you're
talking
about?
That's
the
one I'm referring to. Is it a betting scandal, or is it...
It hasn't been proven that betting was on it yet, has it? Or
no, is it just lack of ability scandal? When you watch it, I don't think it's a lack of ability, sadly.
I think it could be. There was a famous protest from Reading FC fans when they felt their team was underperforming, and they all put underpants on their head, and they had pants, and it stood for players are not trying sufficiently. And I would say that probably that performance was pants.
It was pants, but it was an interesting situation, because that vision was posted to Facebook, and it was on a commercial viewing platform, you know, where you got the link sent you to. But before you got to see the vision of that game, there was an advertisement from a betting company. Now, can sport seriously get its act together with betting? If you are going to stick your hand out and take money from betting agencies, you have no high moral ground to stand upon.
Oh, look, I mean, I think you'll find that there's a lot of sporting international bodies that it is illegal to have betting advertising on your sporting websites.
Yeah.
But you go into some of those websites, and one is a national association in this country, and I know that there is a former national coach who has been actually at them all the time, saying under FIFA rules, there you go, I've told you who it is, you're not allowed to do this, but it still appears when you go on their website. The thing I hate, John, and okay, I'm not a gambler, but I tune in to watch some sport. The last thing I want is the presenter to go, and now we cross to Fred Bloggs for the update on the betting on the game. And then we get 3 or 4 minutes of this guy telling us, I don't care. If I want to get that, I'll go to a bookies, I'll go online. I do not want it as part of my broadcast.
No, and there's a new, it's not new, but there's an advertisement running in Australia at the moment by a certain betting company that claims to be introducing a new style of betting. Spread betting. Mate, have you seen how much damage spread betting has done to sport across the globe? Are you people kidding yourselves? I don't want to hear any sports administrator that gets anywhere near this that then whinges about some betting controversy. You're to blame.
Yeah, look, I think it's a real worry, and we've talked about it before, about these things. To me, once the game starts, you should not be allowed to bet, you should not be allowed to withdraw your bet, you should not be able to place a bet. It's like when the roulette wheel spins. You can't suddenly go, actually, I've changed my mind, I don't want to be on black, I want to be on red. You can't do that. So why isn't sport exactly the same? But the thing that scares me, and I think I've told this story before, in that a friend of mine, his son, I think he's 11 or 12, and he was talking about the Perth Glory. They were playing, this was probably last season, and he said the odds on the Glory win were this, on them to win 3-1 were this, and I couldn't believe, like, a 12-year-old was telling me the betting odds on an A-League game. So then I asked him, I said, well, can you name 11 players from the Glory? Like, you know, when I was 12, I could name all the squad of Swindon Town. You know, I knew even the reserve goalkeepers and the reserve goalkeeper, you know. But no, because you were interested, you were a fan of it, you know, and you followed it. And anyway, he couldn't name 11 players, and he named 3 players that were no longer at the club.
Yeah.
Now, to me, that's really distressing, that he knows the betting odds, but he doesn't actually know the team that allegedly or supposedly he's following. And I think that shows how the power of betting has already got into the minds of the next generation.
It's interesting too, because betting is no reflection upon the standard or the chances of victory. It's what people who have money are prepared to put on it. It's not about a team's chances to win at all. Odds have no reflection on any outcome of any game.
And let's be honest though, John, I mean, betting has been around since Adam was a boy. You
know? Oh, and I'm not against betting. Yeah. I'm quite happy to put my money down on a first past the post. Oh yeah, I'll bet you $5 that so-and-so wins. But when it turns into this mega conglomerate of all these different types of bets and betting in-game, that is disgraceful. I remember, was it McAuliffe with his television satirical show here? We actually played it once, you know, the new FIFA goal technology where the umpire calls the bet maker and asks the bet, you know, it just leads to corruption.
Yeah, I mean, there was a famous game of cricket, I think it was in the 1890s, where a team of one-legged players, so they had artificial legs, played a team of one-armed players. And apparently there was, when you think this was the 1890s in England, there were thousands riding on the game. And I can just tell our listeners who are interested, it was the team of one-armed men that won.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Game of cricket.
But betting on cricket back then was huge.
Oh, look, betting will always be huge, but it's now become such an industry that it's ruining things.
I think it's infected sport.
Oh, yeah, big time. And you know what? Bookmakers aren't that smart, just quietly. They're greedy. But that doesn't make them smart.
And let's be fair, those sportsmen that decide to take the money to throw a game are not that smart either.
No, but that's an interesting point, because why don't I have the ability to bet on myself? If betting's fine and betting's all good and we can all take the money from it and we're all happy with betting and there's nothing wrong with it, why can't I lay a bet against my own performance?
Well, that would be interesting, because say, for example, you were, let's say, 7 or 8 year old hockey player. I mean, you wouldn't be allowed in a bookies to place a bet, but you could get someone to probably place the bet on your behalf. Or even, well, I mean, what age can you start betting? Is it 18?
Must be. I don't know, to be honest.
No, I don't know, to be honest. But imagine that, though. You could say, Dad, I'm going to play for Australia one day. I want you to bet on me representing Australia now. And there's been plenty of parents who've done that, betting on their child making it to international sport. So is that you betting on yourself via your dad?
Absolutely it is.
Yeah, that's a lot.
As soon as you sign a professional contract of any sort, that bet becomes an illegal thing that you've done, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a strange one.
Oh, yeah. You know, it'll never resolve itself. I just like to see sports administrators choose alternative methods of financing themselves and not sell their souls, because they clearly and patently have.
I agree 100%, and I'll bet you there'll be others who'll disagree with
this. Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. They get fouled.
See ya. We'll be back next week.